All right, morning everyone. Nice early start for another day. I was going to call it Tech Ed, but it's not. It's Ignite. Hope everyone's been having a great conference so far. This morning we're going to talk about a not so popular anymore topic of UWP. I'm glad everyone rocked up for it. I know that, you know, for those who have seen me present before, you will have seen me present on things like Windows Phone and then Windows, and now we're sort of bringing that all together with this topic of UWP. And I talk about UWP, but this is actually really about how you build apps for multiple different platforms and multiple different device sizes, right? So the basis of this session you can then take to build iOS apps or Android apps. And in fact, at the end, we'll actually see pretty much the same topic that I'm going through the whole way through, and I'll apply that to an Android app. So you can see how you can then take the learnings from this session and apply it to those. For those who haven't seen me present before, my name's Nick Randolph. I run a company called Built to Roam. Used to be a very specialist Windows company. Now we do cross-platform mobile apps. And being in that sort of app ecosystem, you kind of have to play in the cloud as well, because you quite often need to build a back-end infrastructure. So we're also a cloud partner, so we work primarily with Azure around the, you know, we're not a full Azure dev shop. We don't do everything in Azure, but we do the parts that are relevant to mobile, right? So we use all of the mobile services, what's now rolled into app services, you know, data storage, all of those types of things that are associated with building an app. So I guess we'll start this with a couple of opening slides talking about user experience. Now, hand on heart, I am not a designer. I've worked with a number of designers, so I can generally pick out a good user experience versus a bad one. You know, particularly when we're building apps, I'll go through and be very, very critical about, you know, the user experience and the flow. But I'm not a designer, so don't think that you're going to get any design tips out of this session. But we will look at, I guess, what builds up a good user experience. And so this is broken into sort of two things, one which is more functional and then one which is more very much more design-based. And my thing is not going to work remotely, so I'll step back here. So we'll start off with talking about the layout's got to be clean and effective. If you look back over the history of building apps, we started off basically saying, hey, if we can get as much onto the page and, you know, we'll keep the user happy by giving them everything on one page. And the reality is that all that does is confuse users, right? So it's very much a, okay, let's get on the screen exactly what we need. Let's make it clean, effective. Let's not put curly borders on things unless we really want to. Now, obviously, there are times and places for that. So we build a lot of consumer-facing apps versus a lot of enterprise apps. And if you're building for consumers like to have a really, really nice user experience. They like to have, you know, nice animated backgrounds and things like that. So you can be a little bit more gratuitous with those. Now, in the enterprise settings, at the end of the day, people want to get the job done, right? Now, that's not to say that you build a nasty-looking user interface, because, you know, people like to use a screen that actually doesn't glare at them, right? So it's a matter of finding that balance point about making sure that the layout is clean and effective and that people can get the job done, can get the task done. And that's true, particularly with even in consumer apps, is that you want to make sure that the way that you present things and the order that you present things is done so that the user can get whatever task they need to get done quickly. And the smaller the device, the more that's relevant, right? So if you take a larger device, you can have a bit more on the screen because people will be a bit more accommodating. On a small screen, people want to get in there, get the job done, and get on to doing the next thing and get back to their Twitter feed, right? Because that's what's important, right? Okay, the usage should be intuitive, right? So you shouldn't have to publish an instruction manual for your app, okay? It comes down to that. And it adapts well to different screen sizes and displays. How many people have built an iOS app? Okay, a couple. Android app? Okay, the nice thing about those is that you typically build for one form factor. Okay, so the iOS started with one iPhone, right? And so you built for that form factor. And then when Apple said, okay, well, we're going to change it slightly, every iOS developer went, what? What? You're changing it on me? And it's like, yeah, but things are going to change over time, right? So you need to start designing and building your apps that, with the intent that it's going to target multiple screen sizes and displays. And particularly, this is where UWP comes into its own, because it's actually got some built-in paradigms that we'll see that already allow for you to do that. Unfortunately, other platforms don't necessarily have that. Now, over time, they've evolved. They do now have some of those capabilities. But I would argue that it's still not as strong as and well-defined or well-presented as UWP is. So we'll talk about this a little bit more. It adapts to different user input, okay? That's the next topic is, okay, if you look at the range of devices we can now support with UWP, we've got phone, okay, so that's primarily a touch interface. We've got desktop, laptop, tablet. Those are all keyboard, mouse, and or touch. Okay. If you look at HoloLens, you know, which you can still build a UWP app for, okay, that's a completely different paradigm, right? And yet, you're as an app developer, you're expected to be able to target all of those, right? Now, underneath the hood, UWP actually does some very nice things to make it easier to adapt to those different user inputs. For example, if you have a button on the screen, you don't care whether the user is using a touch or a mouse or a keyboard to interact with that button because it all translates into a click event, right? So you as a developer handle the click event. You don't need to worry about, oh, if the user's using a finger, okay, I need to handle a touch input on that, right? That's already handled for you. So a lot of that comes with the platform. Okay, and we want to make our apps look beautiful, right? So let's use animations effectively, and let's make it pleasing to the eye, okay? Where we're going to spend most of the time today is on these two in the middle. It's more of a functional kind of session. And so we'll talk through, I guess, how we can use some of the platform capabilities to target different screen sizes and the types of things that you need to watch out for when dealing with different input methods. Okay, here's a bit of a sequence for building good, nice, pleasant user experiences. It's interesting, because I actually kind of stole this slide from another session we did. And it's actually not a sequence, really. Yeah, sure, you start with design, but actually, quite often, the BA will come down and say, actually, we need to do this. So the devs will go and say, okay, well, these are the capabilities that we can or can't do. And so you might actually start with the concept of the app before you even get the designers involved. So quite often it's nice to have a designer involved first up, but actually if you leave the user experience just to the designer, you'll end up with something which looks amazing, but is completely unusable, because quite often they don't have actually a user experience background versus a UI background, right? So they might be really creative, they might be able to get it look really good, but actually they've got the buttons in the wrong order, right? Which makes it unusable, or it makes it very difficult to navigate through the app, right? So it's a matter of getting design and user experience together. Intelligent controls we'll talk about a little bit. I mentioned the fact that a button automatically responds to different input controls, input methods. If you look at things like a drop-down list or a date-time picker, those are actually platform-specific. So if you look at the date-time control on Windows Phone versus on desktop, you'll actually see that they render slightly differently. So you can actually have some different renderings based on the platform that they're targeting. Both Windows 10, but that's because they're different device family. We'll come back to that term later on. They actually present slightly differently. Responsive UI, we'll look at how you can scale a UI and do different things based on the screen size. And tailoring for the platform. And we'll talk about the Xbox, which I've got up here, and how you can tailor stuff specifically to that. Because, again, it's got its own user experience because you're driving it mostly from a controller. Okay, so the core of this is really about building multi-platform apps. Now, I say multi-platform, but it's not. It's Windows, right? So at the core of this, it's all about building a UWP app that's going to work across your Windows devices, okay? But before we do that, let's just take a step back and look at the history of... it was going to be a history of time, but it's actually not. It's really more of a history of Windows as a platform. And over the course of the session, you'll see across the top that we're going to sort of progress across this sequence of different things that were introduced along the different paths that Windows has taken. And one of the interesting things that really separates Windows versus, say, macOS is that Microsoft have gone down this path, okay? Whereas if you look at macOS, it really hasn't evolved. Like, you know, I mean, yeah, okay, there's iOS, and that's evolved, but macOS is at its heart. Okay, they keep on adding more stuff to it, but the user experience really hasn't evolved that much, right? It's still got a menu across the top that is completely not sensitive to touch at all, and, you know, your apps aren't really guided at all for touch. Whereas Microsoft have done this transition going from Windows coupled with what started off as Pocket PC, that became Windows Mobile, that became, you know, Windows Phone, Windows, and now we've got to a point where we have this sort of nice balance in Windows 10 between a touch-responsive user experience and one that's led by the keyboard and mouse. Now, we're not there yet, so there's still a little bit of difference between, say, phone and where, you know, running in tablet mode is. And the tablet mode on Windows 10, I still feel very clunky, but and it's still a sort of, to me, it feels a bit of an afterthought, and I very rarely run it. I mean, even though I'm running a Surface Book, I very rarely actually run it in tablet mode. So, brief history of Tide. If we look at Windows, back in, would have been 02, they introduced Pocket PC, and so that went through a natural evolution from Pocket PC, because people didn't understand that brand, they thought it was weird. So they changed it to Windows Mobile with the intent that it would align with Windows. And if you actually talk to these teams over the time, it was interesting because there was a, when they came up with Pocket PC and Windows Mobile, there was very much a, an attitude of desktop in my pocket, right? So you had a start menu that dropped down, you know, and it was cute. But actually, it was kind of hard to use and pretty nasty. But it, actually, as a development platform, it absolutely rocked for its time, right? So if you compare it to the equivalent in what was the, sort of the Java ME space, building for the Compact Framework was just like a joy, right? You're writing managed code. You've got garbage collection, right? Now, that's not to say that you didn't get yourself into memory problems and things like that, because that all happens. But it was quite a nice experience. Sorry, it was a nice developer experience. The experience was very much a Windows 95 style experience. Okay, so that sort of evolved onto Windows Phone, and there was a big sync there between, you know, Windows Mobile, where they were very, very, very enterprise and, you know, Windows 95 kind of look and feel, versus Windows Phone, which was really a consumer-led phone, okay? And there was a big change between the development paradigm there as well. We went from being Compact Framework, which was very much a small version of the .NET framework, across to Windows Phone, which was really based on Silverlight. And so we had a lot of web attitude there that we had to fight for a while. If we look at Xbox 360, that kind of fits in around the time of Windows Phone before they sort of came into the play of Windows 8. And again, it was the same platform that if you were building for Windows Phone, building for Silverlight in the web, it was kind of the same kind of development environment for Xbox 360. And that kind of evolved into Windows 8, and they thought that at that around that time it would be really good for everyone to build Windows apps in JavaScript, okay? Until they tried to present this to them. I think Scott Goo actually said, nah, we can't release stuff like this with just targeting JavaScript. So very, very late in the piece, they introduced the .NET support and the C# support, and that's what a lot of people are now using. So that was very much more popular than the JavaScript model, even though like I think nearly all of the samples were very much JavaScript-driven. And over time, that's evolved into Xbox One development. So the original dev kit for Xbox One was very much the JavaScript model, just because they had to get it into the platform. And that's actually now evolved into the whole Windows 10. So now when you're building for Windows 10, you can target all of these platforms. So phone, desktop, Xbox One. And then the list goes on, right? So we're talking tablet, phone, we're talking Continuum. So I've actually got one of the Continuum docs here that I'll show you what happens when you run a mobile app on the big screen, okay? And that's an important scenario if you've got devices in the enterprise that you're using for the phone, because it means that somebody can walk into a meeting or can actually just sit down at a desk and actually start using their phone as if it was a real PC. So some of the apps that are will actually run in desktop mode even though they're running on a phone. We've got now Surface Hub, and this is where we start to get into those extra devices that the UWP supports that we can target almost for free. So Surface Hub, we've got HoloLens/VR, so that's going to be, UWP is going to be pillar to that success. Now, if you're going to do true HoloLens and VR, you kind of need to break out of a 2D model and get something that's 3D, right? So UWP is not going to serve that. But what it does is it does mean that you've got an instant play in that space, right? Okay, and then we've got iOS, Android, macOS, and Watch, and things like that. So the reason why this is so important is because, of course, Microsoft bought Xamarin, which means that all of a sudden we get almost for free, we get this ability to take what the code that we've already written and go, hey, I want to target these other platforms. Now, I say almost because the user experience is still different. You still need to build the user experience layer for iOS and Android. Xamarin does have a capability called Xamarin Forms that allows you to build a single user experience and actually have it run across those, and we'll see that towards the end of the session as well. Okay, so back in the days of Windows, we built using a technology called Windows Form, or WPF. I'm sure that people have done one or other of those. Have we seen? Oh, yeah, okay, we've all been there. I actually spun up a WPF for the first time in like 3 years yesterday when I was doing the demo prep for this, and I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice if I could actually show a WPF app running? And sure enough, yeah, of course, it's still supported. Windows Forms, I haven't even tried. But the architecture that we were building back then was, you know, two-tier or three-tier at best. I mean, we really were talking, you know, hey, let's build a database app that talks directly to my database, you know. And of course, we've learned a few things through there. The design side of things, very utilitarian. It was very Windows theme based. I mean, a lot of apps just got built using the standard shell. Around the time of XP, there was a lot of interest in trying to get, you know, the Aero type look and feel, your semi-transparency and stuff like that. But it didn't come very naturally, and it was quite a little bit of work to actually get your app to look nice. So we didn't really have this concept of themes and styles and, you know, fonts and templates and stuff like that back then. Okay, but back then, as we moved from just Windows to Pocket PC, and Windows Mobile around that time, those who were working in the mobile space, one of the problems we often faced was, okay, well, we need to do some form of sharing or code reuse, because otherwise we're going to be rebuilding all of the, you know, our entity models and things like that. And out of the box, there wasn't a particularly good model for it in terms of sharing actual code files. What we did, interestingly enough, have, and we've only really just got back to this point, we did have binary compatibility at certain levels, right? So if you were careful in how you built for Compact Framework, you could actually take your Compact Framework library and run it on full framework. And so a lot of people geeked out on the fact that this was super cool and did some nice stuff there in terms of, you know, just your, you know, if you're reusing entity models and stuff like that, you build them as one library that could then be used across them. A lot of people end up just sharing files between projects. And this has kind of evolved. I mean, back then it was very much you'd have all of your files in one project, and then in your Compact Framework project, you basically add files as a link. And that way, when you update it in one, you basically get the benefit of it updating in both. That was a continual headache because you'd update one, you'd use a class or a namespace or whatever that was available in full framework, and then it wouldn't work in Compact Framework. And because you were only focused on building and running the full framework, you'd check in your code, and then somebody else would whinge because you checked in code that then broke the Compact Framework build. So there was a whole bunch of pain associated with that. I do remember actually talking to somebody, and they had like some monster of a project that was literally using file sharing back then between Compact Framework, so their mobile app, and the full framework one. That gets easier, by the way, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Coupling with compiler directives, and what I mean by that is basically when you're building for full framework or you're building for Compact Framework, clearly there's going to be a difference in the user experience. And there's, you know, a full framework, you've got a much bigger display to work with, and there's a much deeper set of classes and namespaces that you can take advantage of. And if you're sharing files between projects, quite often you want to do something in full framework, but it might not be available in Compact Framework. And that's where compiler directives basically allow you to essentially comment code out so that it doesn't need to be compiled for Compact Framework. And of course, that then leads into a management headache of, okay, well, why does it work on full framework and not on Compact Framework? Oh, it's because we commented these lines of code out. The new incarnation of this is the portable class library. So this is kind of getting us back to where we were really goaling with binary compatibility. It's not exactly the same, but it does mean that you can essentially build a library, build it once, and have it reused across a number of platforms. It introduced its own world of problems, and we'll talk about those just a little bit later. Shared projects. Okay, so this is, you can see that these are sort of jumping around here. This is kind of the next incarnation of sharing files between projects. So now what we can do is we can create a project and basically say, hey, all of these files within this project, I want to share between these other projects, right? So you'd have a Compact Framework project, you have full framework, and then you'd have a shared project. And when you add a file to that shared project, it would immediately be added to the Compact Framework and the full framework one. The shared project itself doesn't have an output. It's basically just a tracking list of which files are going to be shared across both projects. Okay, so when you build, it's almost like you copy those files into the Compact Framework project, and the Compact Framework project gets built. They get copied into the full framework, and they get built in the full framework. Okay, so it's just a way of sharing files between those. Okay, device family UX specific XAML files. If anyone's ever done anything with resources, this is kind of akin to that. Okay, so resources, you basically have, if you want to support French, you basically create a resource dictionary that, you know, has a certain extension, and all of a sudden when you run on a device that's got its UI set to French, all of a sudden you'll get the French resources instead of the English ones. This is kind of similar. Okay, so based on this, what we can do is we can say for example, my main page might be mainpage.xaml. Now I can have mainpage.devicefamily-mobile .xaml, and when I run it on the mobile device family, it'll use that XAML file instead of the full framework one. The device families there is mobile, desktop, Xbox, Surface Hub, which is called Team, interestingly, and I think that there's one for HoloLens as well. So, and you can have different user experiences for each of those, and you could do that at the XAML level. If you've got a lot of them, rather than renaming the XAML, what you can do is you can create a folder called Device Family Dice Mobile, and you can chuck all of your XAML files in there. And that's just a nicer way of maintaining that. So it's kind of up to you as to how you actually manage that. And the last one in here is basically the .NET standard libraries. And so Lewis did a session yesterday talking about the difference between portable class libraries and .NET standard. I would highly recommend, if you don't know much about portable class libraries or .NET standard, taking a look at that, because it kind of gives you an understanding of the differences between those. But you can think of .NET standard libraries as the evolution of portable class libraries. And we'll cover those in a second in the demo as well. Right. So let's switch across to Visual Studio. So this is brand new project. Let's go ahead and what we're going to do is I'm going to show you just a demo of some of these code sharing techniques, because if you haven't seen them, they're quite useful even today. So let's just go. So blank UWP app. You'll notice this is 2017, so the folder structure for a new project dialog has changed a little bit. Hopefully they've refined it. They'll refine it a little bit more, because we've still got things like .NET Core versus .NET Standard. We're getting very close. I think they've announced the release date, which is sometime in March. So what was it? Okay. Cool. And so this is running the release candidate. We'll accept the defaults here. I will talk a little bit later about why you might want to adjust the minimum version. You'll notice that in 2017, the default is not the original RTM build. That's because if you've been following the news, they're about to, I wouldn't say deprecate support for the original RTM build, but in terms of if you're a business, they won't provide you business-level support for the RTM one. And that's coming down the path, right? And this is just the natural evolution of trying to encourage people to move forward as Windows as a service, right? So you'll see here that it defaults to the November update. So that was the first update. So they've done two updates. They did a November update, and then they did the anniversary update, which was a much more significant one. And now they've got the creators update, which you would have heard about, and that's this insider preview that's coming up. So the minimum version is basically the minimum version of the OS that you have to have in order to download and run this particular application. The target version basically determines what API set you can target. Okay, and so if the higher, the better, obviously. The thing you have to watch here is that there are some subtle differences if you target a different version than what your minimum version is. And so what you have to make sure you do is you have to make sure you test your app on the different versions between minimum and target, right? So for example, the creators update, in terms of the way fonts are defined, they're actually defined at three different levels now, as opposed to back in the previous one where they were defined at two levels, right? So if you use the default templates that you get and you run it on the insiders one, you may get slightly differences in the fonts, right? And the font coloring. So that's something to bear in mind. We're going to accept the defaults and we'll come back and actually adjust this a bit later on. All right. And so the next thing we're going to do is immediately add in a WPF app. So I'll go add new project, and classic development, WPF app. I'll accept the default for that one. And I'm going to show you a very simple example, right? So let's just go to into our properties, and I will create a new file. And so I'm just going to use this file to basically manage the version of our application. Rather than having two different assembly info files that define our assembly version, I'm going to copy this attribute out of there, and I'm just going to drop it into this file, he says. Now let's try that again. Right. And I import the type. Okay. And what we're going to do with this file is we're going to add it into this project here. So I'm going to go add existing item. I'll navigate back up to my UWP app. Now, this is the file I want, but rather than hitting add, I'm just going to go add as link. Okay, so essentially what that's saying is don't take a copy, because that's what add does, unless it happens to be in your project folder already, in which case it just adds it. adders link, or basically it's the same file, right? So exactly the same file. If I build this right now, it's going to whinge because I've got the version defined twice. So let me just comment this out. And there we have it. I can rebuild this, and life is good. So we've now got the same version or assembly version across those two different projects. Okay. Right. So the next thing we're going to do is actually introduce a portable class library, right? So we're now going to share code between those two projects, right? So I'm going to go new project, and I will go type up here, portable, and we're going to go, I'll leave it as class library one. Okay, so this is going to be our fancy class, and I'm going to call it dumb math functions, right? And I'm just going to have a very simple method in here. Let's call it. And actually, I'll make this a static, so I don't need to actually create an instance of the class. Right. Hopefully, I've got the logic right. So now what we want to do is basically add a reference to that project to both of our UWP app and our WPF app. So I can go into here. It's relatively straightforward. So let's just go and add that class library. And in my main, I'll just make a reference to that. I like the fact that ReSharper automatically picks up the reference. Okay, so I can immediately reference that. Okay, and if I come down here, I can go add, reference, and do exactly the same thing in my WPF app. Okay, import the types for that, and you'd expect it all to build, right? So, okay, so we've done shared files, we've done PCLs. Next thing we're going to show is basically the evolution of shared files. So I will go and create a new shared project. So new project. Let's type shared up here. Okay, shared project. And we'll just grab our file from in here and I'll just drop it into there. So essentially I've moved that file from there into our shared project. Okay, and of course now things are going to break, so I need to then go and add a reference to that shared project. Okay, so I'll add that to my UWP. I want to remove this link here because that file doesn't exist anymore, which you would have seen it just detected. So I'll go add reference on here, and again I'll add the shared project. So we've now got a reference to that shared project by both the UWP and the desktop app. Let's just check that build, it should do. What I'm going to do is that I'm actually going to add some compiler directives into this file so that you can actually see what I mean. So I'll come into here, and okay, it did build, even though it's whinging that it's not finding the, or its compiler is whining a little bit, but it's still interesting when I do a build, it doesn't complain about it. So let's just go and add another file into here. And you'll notice immediately that this is actually going to be accessible from both of our UWP app and our WPF app. So if I come in here, what did I call it? More functions. Okay, so that's immediately available there, even though I added it into that other project. So let's actually come in here and say, okay, but I only want that more function to be accessible to my UWP app, okay? So I can come in here and basically say, if Windows UWP, and it's IntelliSense kicks in, which is great. So now it's going to only be available to my UWP app, even though this file is being shared between those two projects, okay? So you can see here at the top, I can actually switch between the two projects and see what happens, or see what the compiler says. Okay, you can see there that essentially that now, because I've switched to my WPF app, it's actually essentially commented that code out. And sure enough, if I come down here and actually go to my WPF app, you'll see that it won't allow me to create that an instance of that class. All right, so see that it's whinging that it can't actually find that or can't resolve it, right? Which is exactly what you'd expect. All right, so the last thing we're going to do before we jump back to the slides is this library that we created is a portable class library, which is great except for the fact that things have evolved and changed over time and that all good libraries should now be targeting .NET Standard, not PCLs. Okay, so I'm just going to show you how to upgrade those. In 2017, you can actually create a .NET Standard library from the template that comes with it. A lot of existing libraries will want to go through this upgrade process. So it basically confirms that you want to do this. It does change the project structure slightly, obviously, and you'll see that it introduces things like a project JSON file that you'll want to be aware of. Okay, so it's upgraded my library, and now I've got the choice of various different flavors of .NET Standard, or versions, I should say, of .NET Standard. So you can pick the one that's appropriate to you and appropriate to the APIs that you want to use. Right now, I don't think I need to change that at all. I'm pretty certain I can now just rebuild it. But I just wanted to show you what that Visual Studio experience was for actually upgrading those. Right, so let's actually flip back to the slides. And now we're really starting to talk about back into the user experience world. I kind of talked about code sharing, which is very much of a dev thing. Now we're talking about user experience stuff. And for the majority of what we typically talk about in terms of handling different devices, and particularly from a form factor perspective, visual states is probably the key thing that we use internally when we're building apps to track those. Now, you can use properties set on view models that you data bind to hide and show elements based on things. But we typically define all of that in visual states, and I'll show you why in a second when we switch over to Blend, because it means that you can actually see what you're changing at design time, which is very much an important part of building out that user experience. Visual states are almost there from the ground up in UWP. So, for example, if you look at a button, which we'll see in the demo in a second, you can actually break that apart into its different visual states. So a control can actually have visual states. So if you think about a button, it has a regular state. It has a focus state. So if you move your mouse over the top of it, it sort of dims slightly. And then it has a press state. So when you press on it, it changes the visual appearance of it. And within those, in addition to defining the visual states, you can actually define the animations that happen when you transition from one visual state to another. So it's really powerful. Going beyond a basic control, if you look at the page or you look at a custom control that might have more content on it, you can actually define visual states at that level. And one of the interesting projects that we've actually got as a sort of an internal project within Built to Roam is we've actually got a set of libraries that allow you to control states. And they're not really visual states, they're states at an application level. So if you think about page transition within your app, you're actually talking about states of your application. So you might be on main page or you might go to the intro page. Those essentially are different states of your application. And so it's an interesting paradigm to work in because it allows you to declaratively define what your workflow in your app on your page, in your control, is going to be. Okay, so we typically use that to define workflow. Most of our client apps, we don't use it at an application level. We typically just use a traditional navigation between page model. But we do use it to define workflow within a page. So, for example, if you had a wizard, right? So you might have three or four pages that, collect some data from a user, right? Rather than presenting those as different pages, we'll typically have those as, five or six different visual states on the same page. And it allows you to switch between them, it allows you to animate them nicely and things like that. And all of the time monitor what state the application's currently in. All right, let's flip back to our sample. And I'm going to jump forward into Blend. So I'm going to design with Blend. And for the rest of the session, we're going to focus primarily on UWP rather than our WPF app. So let me just close a few of these. One of the things, if you've ever worked with Blend in the past, one of the things you'll notice with the new build is that the differences between Visual Studio and Blend are narrowing. And so there's very few things that you now need to switch to Blend to do. Visual States is one of them. And animations and storyboards and things like that is where Blend comes into its own. You will find that there's some annoying idiosyncrasies between the two. So, for example, you would have seen that Blend decided that it was going to open all of the same files that I had open in Visual Studio, because Visual Studio remembers those. It saves them to a place on disk, and then Blend reads the same things. And so, like, yeah, but in Blend, I don't need code files. I need my designer experience, right? So there's some weird things that are there. So let's grab my main page from over here, And currently, I don't really have a user experience at all on there, which is half the reason I haven't actually run this application up yet. So we're going to go and drop a button onto there. And it's one of those things that's actually just quicker just for me to type into XAML. Right, we have a button. Now, I apologize. Let me see if I can blow the design up a little bit so you can actually see it on the screen. We have a button that's situated hard on the left-hand side. Okay, definitely not a good user experience. A much better one would have it to be center of the screen. So let me just change that. And we'll put it smack bang in the center of the screen. Now, this is going to be one of those annoying apps that has a button in the middle of the screen that says press me. And when you hit the press me, it's actually going to move the button on the screen. Right? Because we all need apps that do that. So states, essentially, what I'm going to do is I'm going to control the position of the states, position of the button based on some visual states. I'll come back to that in a second. What we're going to do before we do that, though, is my button, at the moment, it's very grey. And, you know, I mentioned before that we've moved on beyond just grey. Let me just drill into the button and just change a little bit of the design side of things so that it behaves and maybe has a little bit of different colour when I press on it. To do that, rather than looking over here in the properties list, and to be fair, there are some things like background and foreground colours that you can set, but I actually want to change the colour not when it's sitting there, but actually when I press on it. So I want to change the behavior. What happens when I press? What happens when I hover over it? And to do that, I want to go and edit the template for the button. Okay, so if I right-click on the button somewhere, it's going to give me the ability to go edit template. Let's try that again. Edit template. Edit a copy. Okay. So, thank you, Blend. You might think this looks really annoying, and it is. It actually doesn't happen if you're not presenting. It's one of the weird things that they've done in Blend. Let me close this page. Reopen it again. When you go to present in Blend, they do some weird stuff with the design experience that causes some of the context menus not to behave sensibly. All right, let's start this process in Visual Studio and come back to that. So this stuff you can do in either, and it's going to bomb out in both of them. All else fails, give it a build cycle and let it sort itself out. All right, at least we have an app that doesn't do anything when I hit the press button. So let's just try that design experience again. See whether Visual Studio has sorted itself out. It is nice to know that Visual Studio has the same problem that Blend does. Yeah, I've tried that, because it won't actually let me get into here enough. It's interesting that it allows me to do those. Now I've got to find it from the relative menu. Edit template, there we go. Edit a copy. Okay, we'll call this button style 1. Now what this has done behind the scenes is UWP has a whole series of these templates. Okay, so if you go and you're interested, there is a folder called, what's it called? Windows Kits, this is under Program Files, Windows Kit 10 Design Time, Common Configuration Usual, and you can see the platform version is a file called generic.xaml, right, which looks a little bit like, this. And you can see that there's a whole raft, and you see the progress bar on the right-hand side. You can see this file's quite big, right? These are all the predefined styles for UWP, okay? So you can go ahead and use those out of the box. You don't need to go and customize them. But when you go into Blend and you go right-click on something and you go Edit Template and you create a copy, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take the copy out of there, put it into Blend so that you can then manipulate it. So you don't need to go all the way back to generic.xaml because modifying that on your machine will affect your machine, right? It won't affect everybody else's machine. So you need to make sure you copy the template in here. Let's go to our state. Okay, so this press button, okay, so you can see that it's slightly dimmer. Let's go and override that. If we click on the root element here, you can see I can go and select the background. Let me just go and create, set that to red, okay. And we'll go ahead and apply our application now. And you can see when I'm pressing on there, we now get a different visual state. Right, let's actually add some functionality to our app. So we'll go back here. When I was doing the demo prep for this, one of the things I tried to do was then create more visual states and state groups in here. And if you notice, I've got firstly a red border that should give this away. But second of all, if you look down to the bottom left-hand side, I know it's a bit small, but it says button style in brackets button template. And essentially what that's saying is that you're currently editing the template for the button. And so making additional visual states in here is probably not what I want to do. So I want to escape out of there, so I can click this little up button there. And now I'm back into editing the design for the page. Okay. So we've lost our little button there. Let's move that code out of the way. Let me go and create a state group. So this is going to be my layout. Layout states. And let me just go and create three of those. And so we'll call this center. Now, the center visual state doesn't need to do anything because my button is already in the center. The next one is going to be top. And for that one, what I want to do is basically click on my button, which I will try and do. That was a very long way of doing that. While I'm here, I might as well give that a new name. I think Blender is really, really not happy with me today. It's not even going to let me do that. Let's restart Blend. All right, let's see if we can do that again. So click on top. So we're in visual state editing mode. Click on my button. And over here, if I modify things through the user experience here, it's basically in record mode. So any changes I make here are going to be applicable to that visual state. So I can go vertical line top. Okay, you can see my button's disappeared somewhere to the top. If I click on my bottom, I'm now recording for the bottom visual state. So I can actually vertically align that towards the bottom. Okay. And you can see as I switch between those, it's going to position the button differently for each of those visual states. So let's go ahead and save that. We're going to flip back to Visual Studio and I'll write some code to actually manipulate those. So same code file in Visual Studio. So you can see that it's going generated a few things there. Let's add some event handler to the click event here. Click. And it's generated the code behind. And I'm just going to find out which visual state I'm in first. So var current equals layout states. So this is my state group. If you remember, I renamed that to layout states. I can say current state. Okay, so that gives me a reference to the current state. I can say if current equals center, I can do visual state manager dot go to state. This, because it's basically modifying the page, I need to tell it which state to go to. So I want to go to top. And it actually is weird because it's kind of got some legacy behavior here. It actually requires that as a string, not as a reference. So I need to do dot name. And I'll use transitions even though we haven't defined any. And I'm just going to copy that a couple of times. So that should be, let's just change that to top. Change that to bottom. And essentially, otherwise, we'll go back to center. And we'll go ahead and run that. And so what we should see... Sorry? Only if you'd actually gone and modified the visual state to control where that each of those buttons is, right? So you're controlling the visual state of the page. It's basically, and you can think of the visual state as basically a collection of changes that are going to happen to your page, right? So you have to be prescriptive. You can't just say, hey, all buttons go to the top of the screen. You actually need to be prescriptive about what happens. Huh, okay, my code didn't work. Oh, but it did. Okay, the reason for that is your visual states start in an unknown state, okay? Unless you go to a visual state, the system doesn't know which visual state you're in, so the first time you hit the button, it goes, hey, I don't know which state you're in, I'm going to go to the center state, right? Because that's what we coded, right? But thereafter, it'll actually follow the sequence that we defined for those. All right, so let's just jump back into some slides. Enough of visual states. So the next thing we're going to talk about is basic input. Now, most of us have built some form of an app that requires keyboard and mouse, but the other things to bear in mind is things to do with, right, for example, accelerator keys. What do I mean by those? Okay, well, if you press down Alt, you can get a little tooltip that basically tells you what the keyboard shortcut is going to be for that. Now, in the past for UWP, we essentially had to use a little bit of custom trickery around it. So there's this thing called accessibility properties, and so the idea behind those is you attach them to various elements on your screen, and it gives prompts for the narrator. Okay, so it allows somebody who's visually impaired to basically get a browser experience of your app based on these sort of automation properties. And so the idea was that those automation properties would also correlate to, you know, what the keyboard shortcuts were. But as a developer, you basically had to handle the processing of those keyboard shortcuts yourself. In the latest update to UWP, we can now handle those automatically by defining an access key on there. And I'll show you that in the demo in a second. The next thing to consider is focus versus selected item. And this is particularly important when you start to deal with Xbox, right? On Xbox, you're primarily using a controller to navigate. And so what becomes really important there is the ability for you to step through items without making a selection change. Now, normally on a desktop, you'd use a mouse and you just select the item you want to, or you scroll down and find the item you want to press on. Or if you're using mouse and keyboard, quite often, as you navigate down in a list, you'll expect it to select the next item in the list. So as you're browsing down, for example, your contacts list, just moving the selection down the page, you'd expect the right-hand pane that shows all the details to automatically update with those details, which is kind of the normal behavior of selected items. So selection changes as you move down, right? On Xbox, you really don't want that behavior, because what's going to happen is, because you're on a curated display, as you step down things item in the list, quite often it would automatically refresh to a new page or change the behavior on the page. So the default behavior on Xbox is actually to change the focus state and move the focus state around rather than the selection state. Now, I'll come back to show you a demo on that one, and I want to just highlight the importance of touch interface. There's nothing really specific you need to do unless you want to on UWP around touch, because you automatically get it out of the box, right? So when you use it on a tablet, you can tap on items and they automatically work and they accept an input, the same as if you were using a mouse. Where it does become relevant is obviously when you're building a display and you're actually, you know, working out where things are positioned. If you cram everything right next door to each other, it's fine for mouse and keyboard because you're quite dexterous in terms of where you're pointing. When you come to actually use a touch or a finger to gesture, then it becomes a bit of an issue. So you do need to think about touch from a layout perspective. Of course, you can override the behavior and actually get all the way down to the pointer type, and actually it'll tell you that it's a touch input, and then you can customize things. So for example, touch input, you might want to have some custom display to actually show where they're actually touching on the screen or what they're going to be tapping on. All right, so let me just drop it into our demo, the idea of some accelerator keys. So let's come back to our demo button click. I'm going to cheat slightly, and because I can never remember what the accelerator keys are. And I'll drop these three lines of code, and I'll talk about what they do. Right. So the first one is basically a tooltip. Okay, so this is really useful. These tooltips were around for years, right? They were pretty obvious. Really important in terms of keyboard and mouse, because it means that the user can highlight over something and see what it's going to do. Probably not so relevant in terms of most buttons, because quite often the text that you'll put on the button is probably self-explanatory. But if you have different options in a list, those types of things, and you want to provide a little bit more contextual information, tooltips are a great starting point for that. The automation properties, accelerator key, this is the property I was talking about in terms of presenting something back to the narrator. So again, it's really important to have that so that somebody who's visually impaired can actually use your application and actually get around and navigate your application. The new one that was added is this access key. And you'll notice when I try to run this, it'll actually come up with a build error. And it says, check that the XAML you're using is the minimum version of the platform being specified in the project. Okay, so it hasn't come, it actually registers that that property exists, but it's basically saying, hey, the minimum version you're currently using doesn't support that. So rather than them letting you build and compile it and then just trying to run it on a minimum version and have it fail, which it will, they actually pull that up at compile time. So we'll come into here, and I'll just increase this up to the anniversary update, because that's when that property was added, and I'll run this up, and you'll be able to see what happens when I press the Alt key. So, tooltip, so I hover over there and I get the tooltip. Obviously, if I tried to run the narrator, it would pick up on the automation text. Now, if I press Alt, I get this automatic overlay that basically says, hey, if you press capital O now, it'll actually invoke that button click. Okay, so I can now get that to navigate through there without actually having to click on it myself. Now, what I wanted to just show you as well is, let me show you list sample. To give you an idea of the focus thing that I was talking about, if I go to here. So, the usual behavior in this list is as I navigate down with the up and down with the keyboard, it's automatically updating the right-hand pane with what I've currently got selected. If I press down control, it allows me to basically navigate down up and down this list without actually changing the selection, right? So this is what we've referred to as the item that's in focus, okay? Again, it's not an important, very important thing on desktop, but when you transition to Xbox, it's probably one of the most important things to get right. The reason being is that there is no mouse pointer on Xbox, right? So if you lose focus state on the Xbox, the user goes, huh, what's in focus? And they'll start randomly pressing buttons on the controller until you give them focus again, okay? So it's important that you give them an idea of what they're going to have in focus, okay? And actually, there are some, if you're doing Xbox work, in the next release, so the creators update that's coming out, there is actually a couple of attributes that allow you to define what's going to get focus when you move left or right or up or down on the controller, because one of the hardest things on a page is to control the navigation up and down or left and right on a page, particularly if you're jumping in and out of lists, right, and activating controls like a text box and stuff like that. So, and those attributions basically go in the XAML. They basically say, hey, when the user presses up, go to here. When the user presses down, go to this element. Okay, so it's a really good way of controlling those. Because otherwise, XAML is actually quite hard to control flow of focus. And so you end up writing a lot of hacky code that says, hey, give this element focus when, you know, or when this element gets focus, so got focus event, I want to actually put focus on this element. And we got to the point with one app that we actually had a hidden element there which would grab focus as they moved down the page and redirect the focus to a particular another element. And the reason we did that was because we're not able to take advantage of those new attributes at the moment because we're targeting Xbox from the anniversary update, which is the middle of last year. And so we don't have those new features yet. All right, let's switch back. Okay, form factors. This is an interesting one. Basically, if you look at the different range of devices, clearly they have different physical sizes. That's evident. They have different resolutions. We're all pretty comfortable with that. One thing that people don't take into consideration is actually the viewing distance, right? The reality is, particularly when you're doing something like Xbox or Surface Hub, is that you're standing sort of the minimum of the stage width away from something, right? And Xbox, it could be even further, right? So you're seeing back of the couch, you know, you might have 4 or 5 meters between you and the screen, right? And so even though on Xbox, you're actually building for pretty much the same resolution as a sort of a low-end monitor now, the reality is it's going to be big. It's going to be presented on like anything from a 30-inch screen all the way to an 80-inch screen now, you know. So it will be big, and you've basically got to allow for the fact that the user experience is different. So we went into an Xbox app thinking, oh yeah, well, we've got a UWP desktop mobile app. Surely Xbox can be just the same. Can't we just run the desktop build and just have it work? The answer is no, you can't. And in fact, we went through, well, actually we didn't think it was just going to run and that we'd be happy. We thought we were going to make some minor tweaks to make it more usable and again, adapt to the controller. What we didn't anticipate is the fact that virtually every screen we've had to customize for the Xbox, right? So we use that device family, you know, files for each of our pages. So we have a device specific for Xbox page for every XAML page that we have in the app. Visual state with triggers. So we talked about visual states and how we can transition ourselves. One of the things that Microsoft added to UWP was this notion of triggers. And so they did this because they realized that if developers had to write all this code, it would be a lot of effort to basically track when you run on one size screen and you go to another screen. Or, hey, we're on Windows. How about I even just resize my app down? Okay. And so they thought, okay, well, let's automate this a little bit. And they come up with this notion of triggers. And out of the box, you get an adaptive trigger, which basically monitors the screen size that you're currently on and allows you to trigger different visual states based on what size the screen is. And I put this on here because they did a really nice implementation of this notion of triggers in the sense that there is essentially a base or an abstract trigger that you can go and inherit from. The good news is that this guy has basically come up with a whole plethora of different triggers that you might want to use. We've used screen size, which is the adaptive trigger that comes out of the box. We've used device family, so we've got different layouts or different configurations based on the family size. But there are a whole host of ones, like there's a is type present state trigger or a device or a network connection state trigger. So you can trigger a whole bunch of things. I would warn about using triggers too extensively. Firstly, if you have too many of them, performance does suffer. Second thing is that you can quite easily embed some business logic in your user experience that otherwise you would have tested in your view model just by virtue of the fact that you're using these triggers. So you do need to be aware that you can run into those problems. All right, let's flip back into our demo app. Let's see if Blend's going to behave for me. Let's reload that solution. All right, we're going to create another state group. And this is going to be our auto states. I'm going to create three different visual states. And so the first one... we're going to put these in order, right? So I'll call this small, I'll call this medium, and the metric we're going to use for the triggers on these ones is basically just going to be screen width. We did an app that we worked on. We actually had a whole range of different triggers because we wanted it to look like the mobile interface when it shrunk down width-wise, but also when it shrunk down horizontally, like vertically, we actually wanted it to convert to what would be the landscape layout on mobile. All right, so we had different device triggers based on the width and the height of the app. Here we're just going to do the width, though. So I'm going to click on this little button here that if you haven't worked with triggers, it's a relatively new button, and I'm just going to head and add an adaptive trigger. And this is the large one, so I'll make this, say, 900. I'm going to do the same for my medium, but I'll make this 600. And let me just check the small one. Oh, let me get these in the right order. That one, the small, so I'll make that 0. And I'll make this one, the large, and I'll make that 900. That was an interesting one about selection versus focus state, because I actually clicked on small and the large was in focus, and yeah, they obviously didn't update that. So that's defined the triggers. Now, obviously, we actually need it to do something for those different visual states, because otherwise it's not going to look any different. So let me see if I can select my button again, which is going to cause me problems, I can see. Right, so my button's in focus, and yes, the gentleman's comment about using the keyboard does help. So small, let's just shift it to the left. Large, let's actually shift it to the right, and let's just actually give that a run. All right, so let's just change the screen size. Okay, so as we do that, it automatically triggers between those two. simple as, you know, I literally did not write a line of code to get that to happen. So visual states are very, very powerful from that perspective. All right. So next thing is handling different inputs. So controller versus remote. Okay, so those are two Xbox type interfaces. And dealing with the virtual keyboard. So again, we didn't think that we'd need to make significant changes for the Xbox app. We thought, oh yeah, well, the layout looks pretty good on UWP desktop. You know, when we resize it down, it still looks good. What we hadn't encountered is the fact that, of course, on we didn't really think about the virtual keyboard because on desktop, most people have a keyboard, right? And for the apps that we were building, very few people were actually using the virtual keyboard. And the thing is, if you use the virtual keyboard and elements are not on screen, like the text boxes aren't on screen, Windows does a reasonable job of moving them into focus, and then you can always drag the screen with your finger anyhow, assuming you're using the virtual keyboard. What's different about the Xbox is that you've got this big virtual keyboard, and I'll switch to it in a second. Actually, why not just do that now? Got this big virtual keyboard, so let me just run this app. So this isn't the one I'm just building. It's basically the demo that I did build, but it's essentially the same app. But I've just put a text box at the top. And when I activate that, you'll see this virtual keyboard pops up. Now, the difference between this and on the desktop is when you have a virtual keyboard on the desktop, you're primarily using touch into the end of the screen, right? So if a text box is not in focus, you just scroll the screen, right? And then all of a sudden it's in focus. If I put that text box further down the screen, I've got no way of getting to it, right? And the interesting thing about the controller is that when the virtual keyboard is up, you're locked into the virtual keyboard, right? So I get to the top of here, I can't move the focus around the screen. And similarly, if I go to the bottom of the virtual keyboard, I can't move down the screen. I actually have to actively disengage the virtual keyboard, so back, and now I can, if there were other elements on the screen, I'd be able to navigate around the screen, okay? And then to bring the virtual keyboard up again, I have to press A, right? And so you have to think about getting the layout of those pages to be consistent enough that you can walk through, for example, say, the login prompt. Okay, it's got two text boxes, so they should both be visible. When you enter the username, and for that, you'd want to make sure that, see how there's no at symbol on the keyboard here? Rather than me having to go to symbol and put an at symbol, if you're going to use an email address as a sign-in, make sure you change the input scope on that text element to I think it's email, and that gives you the at symbol, and it gives you the .com type thing on the virtual keyboard. So it's one less step for somebody to do. The other thing is that when they're done with entering their email address, rather than them having to dismiss and then navigate down to go to the password box, make sure you handle the enter key and do something sensible with it, like move focus down into the password box. And similarly, when they've entered the password, when they're done with that, if they press enter, automatically log them in. If you've got a PIN dialog, right, so it's a four-digit PIN, don't have them press enter, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, damn, and it should automatically try to sign in. Okay, if you get it wrong, reset it back to zero and they start again, all right? And so there's a lot of user experience things where you can have to think about how the virtual keyboard plays and how you're going to get rid of the virtual keyboard at the appropriate times, okay? Because the other thing about this is that, you know, when somebody's, let's take the login example. So username, password, I've typed in my username, typed in my password, and I've dismissed the virtual keyboard. Like, I haven't pressed enter for whatever reason, dismissed the virtual keyboard. Why is the focus still in the password box? Move the focus straight back onto the login in button so they can then just hit the A button. It's one less thing that they have to do. All right, so let's switch back for a second. Okay, more inputs. Okay, so we have pen and multi-pen, okay, so particularly with the Surface hubs, okay? So we need to really think about how we're going to build interfaces that support pen, okay? A lot of apps don't lend themselves particularly well to pen because even though pen's been around for a long time, I mean, Microsoft were doing tablet PC stuff with pen back in, 5-10 years ago. But the reality is that pen is now a first-class citizen, particularly on Windows with the new update that's coming, is that, from the notification tray, you can go into pen mode and you can take a screenshot of what's on there and annotate it. You can do a blank screen, scribble on stuff. And so there's a really rich interface on Windows itself to support pen. And this is going to start app developers to think about how they can integrate pen. There's a new built-in ruler that you can use, so for doing straight lines. You can actually come up with your own custom rulers, which is pretty cute as well. And we've got multi-pen support. So for things like the Surface Hub, it's a collaborative experience. So you want to take advantage of pens. And I was talking to somebody the other day who was bemoaning the fact that their organization has a couple of Surface Hubs in their sort of innovation center. And all of the apps they were using didn't respond very well to multiple pens. So it was still a single user experience. The good apps and some of the first-party apps actually do handle two different pens because it treats them differently. They've actually got different identifiers. So that, and in code, you need to handle those specifically yourself because obviously Microsoft can only take you so far. They can't predict how you want to treat those two pens. So for the most part, it treats the two pens as the same out of the box. But you can write custom code for each one based on the pointer identifier. I mentioned you can do a ruler and a custom ruler and actually switch over to one of the sample apps that actually shows you how to do that. And OCR is an important part of that as well. Out of the box with WP, we get this ability to do OCR. So when we're writing stuff with a pen, we can get it converted into text to provide that natural language. In the past, you would have brought up the virtual keyboard, and one of the options in the virtual keyboard is basically a pen input panel, and so you can use that to generate text. But now you can actually do OCR directly within your app. So let me just show you that using the ink sample. So this is one of the samples out of the box. Okay, if you haven't seen the samples, there's a staggering number of them. So this is the UWP samples. I find the best way to get your samples, you can download them individually. Best way is to go to GitHub and literally copy the repo, right? So I've cloned it, so periodically I'll go in and resync, which gives me all the latest samples. And there's a lot of them, right? So it pretty much covers everything you want to do, right? And so this is one of the inking ones. And so out of the box, you get things like the ruler, okay? So you can control that. Now, obviously, I'm using this with a mouse, but I can quite easily just pick up this and do the same with a pen. So it handles those. If I come down to, I think, scenario 8, okay, so this is actually a custom ruler. It looks like just an object on the screen because they haven't really stylized it to look like a ruler. But if you think about what a ruler is, it's basically just an element on the screen that's got this ability to draw the ink towards it. So basically, as you draw near it, it basically pulls the ink and actually aligns it along the edge of the ruler. That's what it's doing underneath the hood. And so when you write a custom one, literally, that's all it's doing, right? So as I draw there, I had to be relatively close to the edge of the object, but it basically draws the ink in and aligns it with the edge of that ruler. And so this notion of wet ink, and what it does is you get those events that are associated with that. So the wet ink, you basically work out where it is, work out where the ruler is, and draw it into it, and actually redraw it based on where the ruler is. So it's a cute idea, and it's almost like a preprocessor for the ink support. So anyway, the sample code's all there to actually use that. The next thing I'm going to talk about is visual state management from a coding perspective, right? So far we've talked about we've defined visual states on the screen for the button and for the page. We've triggered them in the code behind. But realistically, one of the nice things about visual states and the notion of of states in general is that you can think of your page going through these different visual states. And of course, if you're used to using things like a view model to drive the data for the page, there's no reason why you can't drive the visual state of the page from that view model as well. And so what that means is a couple of things. Firstly, it means that when you're writing your view model code, you can actually think of your view model being those states as well. So you're not having to expose properties that say, hey, turn this element on or off. You can actually control it by saying, hey, I want to be in this visual state or this state. And the other artifact of that is it means it's testable, right? So all your view models should be in a portable class library or a .NET standard library. Because it's just code and there is no actual visual presence to it, it just means that it's completely testable. So you can actually say, hey, you know, run this method and I should be in this state. And run this method and I should now be in this state. So you can actually test that because the states are defined. Okay, so how do we do that? Let's go back to Visual Studio and I'm going to just spin up I'm going to show you a NuGet package that makes this life really easy. So this came out of a lot of work we've done for a lot of different clients where we manage visual state across a range of different projects. So I'm going to add this buildit.states library to both my class library and my UWP project. And so what I'm going to do in my class library once this is added in, I'm going to come in here, and normally I'd break this out into a separate file, but for the time being, I'm just going to reuse the same file. I'm going to create a main view model. So notify base is actually part of that builder.states library. It's basically a basic implementation of iNotify property change. In fact, I don't actually think that I use that, but I do it by default whenever I'm creating a view model, just so that I know that I have an implementation there. And we're going to define a bunch of states, so public, enum, layout. And you'll notice that the names of these states do have to align with the ones that I'm going to have on my screen. You'll notice I've also included base, and that's again so I can mirror the behavior of what's going to happen on the screen, right? So in my app, the default visual state, there isn't a default one, right? So you can think of that as base. You can never go back to base, but you can. It's basically an identifier to make sure that you know if you're in a state or not. So in our view model, we're basically going to create an implementation of iStateManager, and I'm actually going to cheat because I realize that we're time poor, so let me just jump over to here where I already have my main view model, and I'm just going to grab a copy of this class and we'll just drop it into here. So what we have here is we have this thing called a state manager. We used to do a lot of this as base classes, but then I realized that the problem with that is that then we have to prescribe a certain base class onto everyone. So we actually have this separate thing called a state manager now. And within there, similar to what we saw in the visual layout and the visual states, we can define groups. Okay, so we have a state group, and we're defining that based on layout states. And here I'm literally saying define all states, because within my code right now, I don't need to define specific elements of those states. What I want to be able to do, though, is I want a method called toggle states that allows me to transition between those. Okay, so this state manager will recognize it provides us a mechanism to actually retrieve what the current state is. Okay, this is looking very familiar. It's basically the exact same code that we wrote in the UI domain, so in the code behind, but now we've got it in a portable class library. Okay, and you might be going, okay, well, that's all great, but how do we then wire that up into our application? And so if I come back to my app, and so what we're going to do here is we'll actually drop out the original code that we had. And we're going to need to create an instance of our state manager. So let me just jump over to my sample that I had before. So I'm just going to steal a little bit of code from there as well. And so we'll do that up here. And for that, we're going to need a couple of local variables. Okay, so we're creating an instance of our view model, creating an instance of a state manager. Okay, so this state manager is going to handle the states within the page as opposed to the states within our view model. And what we're going to do, because we're going to base them on the same enumeration, we're actually going to bind them. And literally all I need to do here is view model.toggle states. And when I run this, again, same behavior, but this time it's not being controlled by the code behind. We've actually got it separated off into our portable class library. Boom, automatically testable. Okay, so it's a big difference there. All right, so we're almost there. What I wanted to talk about a little bit more is just the code layout. Okay, so you've seen how I've basically built up those, the structure of our project. We basically have a portable class library, so a core library as such. And then we have our platform-specific user experience. And when you go into the Xamarin world, you see that with Xamarin Forms as well. And there's two options with Xamarin Forms. There's a shared project version and a PCL-based one. I normally have both a core project, so that's got my view models. I then have a Xamarin Forms view project. And then I have head projects for each of the platforms I want to target. Okay, last note is that there is each of the platforms has its own design experience in Visual Studio now. And even Xamarin Forms doesn't have one in Visual Studio yet, has it in Xamarin Studio for Mac, but that has a design experience as well. So if you haven't looked at Xamarin Forms, I would encourage you to. The last thing I wanted to show you just in passing, just to end the session, is this is the Android emulator. And what I want to show you, let me see if I've got it here. Let's see if this one's the right one. So literally all I did to get this to work is I basically, this uses exactly the same states library, so exactly the same portable class library. I've got exactly the same behavior on the screen with my Android app. And so there's no design time experience for visual states in Android, but we've got an extension in the code library that allows us to switch between those. So, all right, that's pretty much the end of the session. I hope you all got something out of it. If not just a basic understanding of visual states and how important they are. I would encourage you to take a look at them, particularly if you're trying to support multiple platforms, because it is the pillar of what we do in terms of supporting Xbox, desktop, and mobile. So thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of Ignite.